The reporter who knew too much. The mysterious death of What's My Line television star and media icon Dorothy Kilgallen. Mark Schar with us. We'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Mark Schar with us. Mark, how thorough a job can a district attorney do with a case that's almost 52 years old?
Well, it's interesting. People are obviously listening to your show, George, because I got an email with just about that same question here. So, and they were wondering too, about, you know, how Kilgallen, if Kilgallen was so powerful, how did she get? How did somebody kill her? And I think those questions are interrelated.
Well,
I don't know how much time they're going to spend on this. You know, I'm hopeful. There's a reporter in Columbus where Ron Pataki lives that's also looking into this, and the New York Police Department, I understand, has gotten involved in the investigation. So I don't know how far they will go. They're probably asking themselves, too, the same question that this person did with the email. If Kilgallen was so powerful, how could somebody kill her? Well, I think she thought she was invisible.
Well, look at JFK.
Invincible.
Look how powerful he was, and somebody killed him.
Exactly. I think she thought she was invincible. You know, one thing we have to think about is how powerful she was. And if I may give you an example, she covered some of the most famous trials of the 20th century, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case,
mm-hmm.
the Profumo scandal in Britain. But one of them was the Dr. Sam Shepard case,
that,
which became The Fugitive.
The television show The Fugitive,
exactly.
You're right. Exactly.
And, you know, she was one that shouted Dr. Shepard was not guilty. He was convicted. And later on, after the judge died, I happened to practice law with F. Lee Bailey at one time, and Lee says that, you know, after the judge in that case died, Dorothy got a hold of him and said, listen, I went to that trial, and the judge called me into the chambers and wanted an autograph and all this. And he said, first of all, why are you here? And she said, well, it's such an exciting case. And he said, oh, for Christ's sakes, he said, that he's guilty as hell.
The judge said that. Unbelievable.
The judge said that. And so she told Bailey. Bailey then used that in his appeal to the United States Supreme Court, and that is what overturned that case. That's the kind of power, you know, that she had. So I think that, you know, in her lofty status, she thought nobody could touch her. And the district attorney probably is looking into saying, hey, we need to find out how somebody could get close to her because she was such a powerful woman. And I think if they put some resources into this and they follow the fresh evidence that I presented, look at all the videos, talk to Pataki, talk to other people, and use some of hopefully some information that people may pass along. I can tell you tonight for the first time that I've mentioned it to anybody, George, I've heard from some relatives of Dorothy's now, and they've been scared to talk about this for years, but I think they will talk to me, and I may learn some good information, you know, some inside information that nobody knows about what happened to Dorothy.
It is an amazing story that deserves to reach some conclusion, I think.
Yes, and she deserves that, yes.
And with your work, you know, who knows? We'll see what happens. Well, as you said, Pataki, as you say, should be a suspect. He's 81 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He was a friend of hers. They were close. There's no question about that, right?
Yeah, and I think he was, you know, I think at some point whoever, and again, don't want to give away the mystery in the book, but whoever did harm Dorothy and cause her death, I think Pataki was, you know, connected to those people. I think these poems are kind of a way for him to let out some of the guilt that he had that way. You know, it's hard to go back in time and figure out what was going on at that particular time. But you know, she was investigating the biggest case, you know, of her lifetime, and the mystery now of her death is kind of connected in with the mystery of JFK's death. They're kind of intermingled there, and I think people will find that fascinating when they read about it.
And she was how close to getting the book out?
Well, there's some conjecture about that. You know, I'm like you. I want to present the truth. And so I've used as many primary sources as I can in the book, people that were there, people who knew Kilgallen, not speculation of any kind. I think she was very close. The file, we've had it described by, you may know that one of her other lover that she had at the end of her life was Johnny Ray, who was the popular singer, the little white cloud that cried and all of that.
Oh,
and
yeah, that's
a
right.
A gentleman that I interviewed who's down there in L.A. where you are was working on an autobiography with Johnny. He told me that Johnny believed that Dorothy had been murdered. And this they described that file as having all of that, the documents, her interview she had. She was able to get inside the Dallas Police Department. All of that was in there, and she had shown Bennett Cerf, who you remember was on the show and the co-founder of Random House, she had showed him a chapter or two actually on the very night before she died, and he was enthused with it, but then that file disappeared, and so that book was never written.
What a shame. And what also is a shame, a lot of these players are dying away.
Yeah, it's been kind of amazing to me that actually so many people are still alive. I was just put on by a reader again to some information about somebody that was very close to Carlos Marcello's ally, Santo Traficante, who lives in Florida, apparently drove for Mr. Traficante, and he may have information about this. He's still alive.
Oh, that's a great story.
A tutor that was there in the Kilgallen townhouse the night she died, he's alive, and I've interviewed him. So I'm hearing from a lot of people about things, and I'm hoping that they will either contact me or the DA. I mean, it's amazing. In one email, they call Dorothy a patriot, you know, for looking into the JFK assassination. One reader, George, has visited her grave.
Wow.
And swept away the leaves and is taking some flowers there. One suggested that she be her photograph be on a postage stamp. I mean, one thing you asked me, what do I hope comes out of this? Well, one big thing is that her reputation be restored. She was looked upon at the time as a drug addict, perhaps, and an alcoholic, and that was so far from the truth. This woman was such a remarkable person and journalist and all of that. So I'm hoping, and it seems to be happening, that people are recognizing the fact that this reputation should be restored.
And does anybody remember anybody going up to her apartment with her?
Well, not on that particular evening. Johnny Ray had been there.
Too bad we didn't have video in those days.
Her husband was around. I believe it shows in the interviews with Pataki that he visited there. But we don't know really what happened between the Regency Hotel, where she was seen about 1 o'clock in the morning, somewhere in there, and then until the next morning. And if you want to see a chilling video, go to the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, and you will hear Mark Sinclair, her closest friend and hairdresser, describe going to the apartment at 9 o'clock in the morning.
He found her.
Going upstairs to fix her, you know, to get her ready with her makeup and everything, and then discovering her sitting up in the bed and finding her dead. It's a chilling video, and not for the meek at heart, because, you know, it just was devastating for him. And but that's an eyewitness, and we don't know what happened between the time she left the Regency Hotel and when he found her at 9 o'clock. And then there's some problem, because the authorities weren't called to the middle of the afternoon, and we don't know exactly what happened during that time.
Mm. Okay, let's take some calls for you, Mark. Let's go to Ernie, truck driving in Ohio, to get things started. Go ahead, Ernie. Welcome to the show.
Hello, George. It's good to talk to you both.
Thank you.
I saw an episode of Pawn Stars. It's probably been a couple years ago, and there was a man on there that was trying to sell these papers of Lee Harvey Oswald. I don't know if they were his or his lawyers or whatever. But all I remember about the episode was that he said, well, after you read these, you'll believe that Oswald was innocent.
Wow.
And so you might want to go over there, archives or whatever, and see if you can find this story or find out who that gentleman was that had them papers, or if he sold them or what. You know, I can't remember. It's been so
all
long
right.
ago.
But we'll write to them. You might be able to find that.
That would be most interesting if those exist. You know, you always hope, you know, I suppose, Ernie, do you know that supposedly in October, I'll believe it when I see it, but they're supposed to release all of these documents about the JFK assassination. The government is under court order.
We'll believe it if we see it.
They find some things out then as well.
We'll believe that when we see it. I think Oswald was what he said he was, a patsy.
Yeah, I think so, too. He you know, he was part of the whole thing, I believe. But again, Dorothy thought he was a dead end, and so do I. Ruby was the key. That's what she was focusing on.
All these people knew each other. I mean, why doesn't anybody realize that this is not coincidental? That just doesn't happen. You know, you don't get the, you know, Jack Ruby knowing, you know, Lee Harvey. I mean, they knew each other.
Yeah, but again, I will say to you one name, J. Edgar Hoover. He turned people's direction, you know, people's face, their thoughts and their ideas about what happened in the wrong direction.
Well, that's an interesting take. Why would he do that?
Well, because,
what did he
again,
have to gain?
If it's a lone nut who causes the death of JFK, then he's not responsible. If it's a planned group of people with motive to kill, want to kill Bobby Kennedy because, you know, they hate him so much, but if they kill Bobby, Jack will come after them with everything the government has. So they kill JFK, so Bobby is powerless, which is exactly what happened.
That's right.
And he's in trouble because he should have known about that occurring. So he's, I don't want to use the too much language on your show.
No,
but
don't.
His own ass by saying it's Oswald alone. And that just turned everybody's, you know, attention in the wrong direction.
Let's go to Columbus, Ohio. Lamont is with us on the wild card line. Hi, Lamont. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, how you doing, my man? Thanks
Good.
For taking my call. It's
Thank
interesting.
You.
I've been a Kennedy, you know, nut for a while. The one thing I wanted to explain is that Jim Garrison had a job to do, and it was to immediately deflect the blame from the mafia to the government. See, if you blame it on the mafia, and any layman American will believe you, but if you blame it on the government, only 30% and under maybe will even give you a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they get to play on the 70%, cover it up, and then they can get away with it until, you know, now. But I wanted to say that Jim Garrison, what proves it is, even in the JFK film, see, if you look subliminally or look, you know, behind the people and listen and look, I've absolutely took it to the lab like a coach. And if you can see the things they're giving you, and what they one thing they did give you, and you probably never heard this before, was the Fontainebleau restaurant. The Fontainebleau restaurant in New Orleans is controlled by Carlos Marcello. Now, in the beginning, when he first started to reopen the investigation, they were in the Fontainebleau. Like, that's where they had their meeting at. So, that's where they had their meeting.
Yeah.
So, when he entered to the restaurant, the waiters and the concierge, everybody went up to him and said, "Hey, how you doing, Mr. Garrison? Hey, thanks for anything." He was like, "Yeah, you know, I've been busy." He said, "Your usual?" "Yeah, I'll take my usual." And you think it's just a random restaurant, but if he's carte blanche in a mob-controlled restaurant. Not only that, but upstairs a hotel. See, Joe Pesci's character, I can't remember his name.
David Ferry. He played David Ferry.
When David Ferry first opened up to Garrison after he realized he was going to die, they said, "Meet me at the Fontainebleau at 4 o'clock. And they ran up there and spilt his guts, probably in a bugged room. And next thing you know, he gets killed right after that. Anybody who talked to Jim Garrison and said anything about the mob got killed.
Hmm.
And it's easy to see that Jim Garrison was catered to by the mob, and also when they had that meeting, when the guy got up and tried to tell him about the mob, he stood up and said, "Can the mob control the government? Can the mob change behavior? Can the mob get Oswald to rush in back?" But what he did, so he was there to deflect it from them.
All right, let's get Mark's take on that. Mark, what do you think about that?
Well, anything you want to talk about with Marcello, I'll do that, because just come on, use some logic here, for God's sakes. I mean, Joe Kennedy uses the mafia to win the election, tells them that they'll if they win, they'll leave the mafia alone. Bobby, I had an eyewitness, John Sigenthaler, who was a very respected journalist, was right there the night when Joe said to JFK, "Bobby will be attorney general." Bobby's attorney general. He goes after all those people. The first guy he deports is Carlos Marcello, who gets back in the United States. And as November 63 comes along, Marcello is in a courtroom in New Orleans facing conspiracy charges and racketeering charges, and Bobby's going to deport him. Now, come on. You know, this is a $6 billion business that Marcello's running. He's not about to let that happen. So just look at simple motive. And I think that, you know, there's no question Dorothy realized that Marcello masterminded the assassination. You kill JFK so Bobby is powerless.
You think she was going to name...
What happened, and Marcello and none of them were ever bothered again.
No, they weren't, and they died, and so be it. Now, Johnny Roselli, was he involved in this? And he ended up getting killed. Somebody bopped him.
Well, that's a sad story. I mean, he ended up in a barrel, remember, with all of his body parts scattered about. He's another mystery figure.
He was with the group.
I didn't get into him because I still feel like there's an awful lot of speculation there about him. And I again, George, I like primary sources and really trying to hone in on things that I believe are truthful and not just speculation.
I don't think you ever met Dorothy Kilgallen. She was long gone before you were of age, right?
Me?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, no, I remember her. See, I remembered her from What's My Line, too. And here's what I think happened. People have asked me, why didn't the Warren Commission call her? Why didn't Jim Garrison talk to her? You know why, I think? Even though she wrote all those columns and everything, they thought about her as a game show panelist.
Yeah.
What can this woman know? In the FBI files that we have in the book, and I think, you know, the term that Hoover used was, she was flighty and irresponsible. She was looked upon as, okay, fine, well, she found these things, but she's a game show person, so we're not going to pay much attention
to her. She got stereotyped.
There you go.
Yet she was a great columnist, and man, she was gutsy.
Nobody can touch her. There's not a journalist alive. I mean, a radio show in the morning, the syndicated newspaper column, the investigative reporter covering all the trials, raising three children. I mean, she was an adventurer. She was all these things. She was a remarkable woman, and I have such respect for her, and hopefully the justice that was denied for so many years will be hers now.
Does anybody know? She had three children. Are they still around?
They are, and people have asked me, and I put this in the book, why they did not want to get involved. It was a tough situation for them near the end of their life. Dorothy Kilgallen's husband, Richard Kommer, was a Broadway producer. That had gone sour. He opened three restaurants. Those hadn't worked out. It was tough being Mr. Dorothy Kilgallen, and he had an alcoholic problem.
Yeah.
And started running around on her and doing some different things. So that was sad. And then there were some fights with the daughter, Jill, and Dorothy about this affair she had with Ron Pataki and with Johnny Ray and that kind of thing. And then, you know, Dorothy dies, and they say she's a drug addict and an alcoholic. And just a couple years, I think it's 2 years or 3 years afterwards, Richard commits suicide. They just don't have much of any good memories about their time with their parents. Now, what I did is I talked to Jill. And I told her that I would send her the manuscript, and if they did not approve of me publishing the book, I would not publish it.
That's pretty gutsy on your part.
Well, I wanted to do that because I had sensitivity for the family there.
Well, the book got published.
I asked Jill if she wanted it, and she never got back to me, and so I assumed that she felt like it was fine for me to go ahead and publish the book, and that's what I did. But I haven't heard from them yet. I hope that I do. But bless them, I have some sympathy for what they went through during those years around Dorothy and Richard's death.
All right, we're going to come back and take final calls with you, Mark, in just a moment. The reporter who knew too much. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take final calls with Mark Shaw, the reporter who knew too much. Amazing work he has done in this book. Absolutely amazing. And welcome back to Coast. Mark Shaw with us, the reporter who knew too much. We're talking about the death of Dorothy Kilgallen, the very strange death. What do you think she was going to come out with? You know, we talked about my thoughts and my theories, and you said they might have been very similar to hers. Mm-hmm. Do you think she was going to come out and name names in this book, Mark?
I do, and at the end of the book, I tell people what I think would have happened if she had lived. I believe she would have written the book. I think she would have exposed Carlos Marcello for being the mastermind of the assassinations. I think she would have produced enough evidence to show that J. Edgar Hoover had tried to cover up everything that happened. I believe that she would have triggered a grand jury investigation. And I think all of the evidence and documents, everything that she was able to collect would have resulted in Marcello being charged, with J. Edgar Hoover being charged.
Wow.
Others, accomplices, whatever it may be, that way would have been charged. And I even say at the end of the book, I think Dorothy Kilgallen probably would have won the Pulitzer Prize for producing the truth about one of the greatest murder mysteries in history, what happened to JFK. So it's just sad that she was erased, that her hard work and all that she had accumulated has been buried for 50 years, and hopefully now people will realize what a remarkable woman she was, and the fact that she would have really changed the course of history with what she had discovered about the JFK assassination.
She would have been about 107 in July of this year, so I'm not sure she would be with us today, but she would have had a much longer life than her 52 years.
52 years old, George, when she died. 52.
Yeah. Not much at all. What about Marilyn Monroe? Did that come up? Did she come up at all in Dorothy's work?
Well, a lot of people have asked me about the similarities because, of course, Marilyn Monroe was found in the bedroom, you know, with the drug problem and the drug overdose and that kind of thing. Same situation with Dorothy. You know, Dorothy actually wrote a column about Marilyn Monroe's death, and that's in the book. She talks about, you know, what happened to her, and that she doesn't believe that it was an accidental death. And then she just says some wonderful words. You know, Dorothy had a poison pen that you talked about. I mean, Frank Sinatra was an enemy of hers. Jack Parr was. Other people were. She could make or break a career, as you said. But she could also be very gracious. And she was to Marilyn Monroe in that particular column. I think she admired Marilyn for what she had done and all of that. So that's all that we know. Some people have asked me whether I would ever look into Marilyn's death, but there's not the primary sources there that provide the kind of information that I would want to write about Marilyn's death that I found with Dorothy's.
Well, that's true. Okay, let's go back to final calls now. Kathleen on the Big Island in Hawaii. Hi, Kathleen. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hey.
Good evening.
Good to have you with us.
All right. Thank you. So, Mark, I'm very intrigued with your book. I'm quite a reader. I'm 65 this year, so I'm involved in the whole whatever story. But what I wanted to ask you is, years ago, I heard about a book written by Deborah Davis. It was called Catherine the Great, and it was about Kitty Carlisle and her connection with the Kennedys. Have you read it, and what can you tell me about that? Because I've never found the book.
No.
I have not either.
That's news to me and something I will look into. One of the hairdressers in the videos that are on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org website talks about Kitty Carlisle. Apparently there were some hard feelings between them when Kitty was a panelist on that show. You know, Dorothy even had some problems with the other panelists because she was a reporter first and a panelist second. And so two or three times when there were some inner fighting or she learned about something, she would print that. And I think that's what happened with Kitty Carlisle, where she printed something and they didn't care for it very much and told her so. But I've got written down the name of the author you're talking about, and I'll see if I can't find that book because, you know, it's people like Kitty Carlisle who were there at that time, and I believe she has passed away, but you never know whether there's someone in her family that she may have talked to about this. So I'm following every lead that I possibly can. So I thank you for that information.
Okay, let's go to Summer now in Panama City Beach, Florida. Hi, Summer. Go ahead.
Well, you took the words out of my mouth. I was going to ask you about the similarities between Marilyn Monroe and her, but I'm very interested in learning more about Dorothy. It sounds like she was way ahead of her time, but you already took my question. You talked about it already, but I'm definitely interested in reading your book and learning more about this.
It's a great book and a great
very
story.
Very interesting, and I think she was ahead of her time, but go ahead and take another call because you already answered my question.
Just Summer, I think it's interesting you say she was ahead of her time, and how many people have said to me, I wish Dorothy, the kind of reporter that Dorothy Kilgallen was alive today. We need more Georges out there too who are really searching for the truth, because unfortunately in the media these days there's not that integrity that Dorothy had and that George has very much, and that's sad. You know, it's really sad, and yes, she was ahead of her time. I've heard from some young journalists who see Dorothy as a real inspiration. You know, she did fight her way up. And back in that day, George, you know, women were supposed to be in the 50th row. They weren't supposed to be up front doing anything, but Dorothy wasn't to be denied. And so I think she is a true inspiration, Summer, and I hope you feel that way about her when you read the book.
You know, my parents used to watch What's My Line all the time, every week. And, you know, I would remember the players on the cast, Arlene Francis and Bennett Cerf and Dorothy Kilgallen. And, I mean, just even Steve Allen was on that for a while, wasn't he?
20 million people watched that show every Sunday night for 15 years. And the thing is, you know, when my agent took this to publishers, they would say, well, nobody remembers her under, you know, 50. But that's not true, because all of these reruns of What's My Line are on something called the Buzz Channel and other places on the Internet. You can watch them. And I've had people tell me that they've gone back to that show because here's what they call it, an intelligent game show.
Yes.
Unlike many of the things we have these days. And I think your parents would agree with that. It was that way.
Well, I get a kick out of the little flip money signs that John Daly had and things like that, instead of the high technology that we have today.
Right, exactly.
All those days. I even remember election returns, Mark, where a guy was up in a ladder changing the numbers by hand.
Really? I don't think that happens today, no.
Let's go to Toronto, Canada. Terry's with us on the international line. Hi, Terry. Go ahead.
Hey, George. And let's not forget that the top prize on What's My Line was $50.
Which was big money then.
That was big. Yeah, I guess it was back then.
Yeah,
yeah, really. Mark, I wanted to ask you, I have read Bennett Cerf's autobiography called At Random. He started it, and I believe he passed away before it was finally published and his son completed it. But he does get into the whole relationship between him and What's My Line and Dorothy Kilgallen, of course. And it almost sounds like there's a bit of an oil and a vinegar thing there between the two of them. But he, in his autobiography, he never gets into any of the things that you've been talking about tonight vis-a-vis JFK and that. And I was just wondering if you could, if you have read that particular autobiography by Bennett Cerf, and any comment you might have.
I have it right over here on the shelf, Terry. And, you know, you read that book and you do get some inside information about what was going on with What's My Line. And he and Dorothy crossed paths sometimes and weren't agreeable with things that happen. But here's the thing about Dorothy that I found. You know, George mentioned the enemies and things that she had. Well, she and Bennett Cerf didn't get along. She and John Daly at times didn't get along. But they had respect for each other. And especially Bennett Cerf, you have to think, was the co-founder of Random House.
That's right.
Even though he didn't agree with some of the things Dorothy did on the show, he's the one that gave her the advance to write the book for Random House about the JFK assassination. And so she was able to straddle, you know, the fence in terms of being the competent integrity type reporter and reporting the truth. But also, even when it offended people, there was respect for her. And I'd like for you to find somebody today like that, that can do that, who speaks out very much. The host of this show is one of those people, and I'm not just applauding him because I'm on here, but he's like that. People respect George because just what he said, he's gonna present the facts. And when you're like Dorothy and you're like George and you present the facts, you're going to get that respect.
You know, it's amazing about the television programs of those days, too, Mark. You know, all older people were the hosts or the panelists. You won't find that today. Today, television is geared toward a younger audience, and that's what they push for. But when you look at the old tapes, you go, wow, would they succeed today? I'm not sure TV would go for it.
No, I don't think they would. I don't think a show like this would have a shot. You know, I normally don't with my books look at Amazon reviews, but there's almost 100 up there. And I have looked at them this time because I really wanted to see what people had to say. Most are very kind about the book and all of that. But I wanted to see what the perceptions were. And, you know, in many of them, there's a common theme. They love the old days.
Yep, nostalgia.
They love the old days when the things that you're talking about happened. They're not very happy about the things that they're seeing today. And I think that is a common theme, you know, and it's somewhat unfortunate in many ways, isn't it?
Mark, would you give out your websites? We've got links on coasttocoastam.com, but for folks who are driving around, give us your sites.
If people want to know a little bit more about my checkered career and the books, it's markshawbooks.com. Really, the first site that we put up was the reporterwhoknewtoomuch.com, and there's a book trailer and a lot of information up there about the book. But the one I like the most, we decided to put everything up there that we could find about Dorothy, the interviews, the quotes, the columns, the articles, the photograph, you know, everything's up there. And it's the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. And I want that to last forever. We're adding some things to it as time comes along. A reader the other day, George, told me that she and her brother happened to be in Daly Plaza during the Jack Ruby trial, and they saw Dorothy Kilgallen, and they took two photographs of her.
Oh.
And that woman is sending those to me. They'll be here tomorrow. So it's just absolutely amazing some of the things that people have come up with that
really
just warm my heart that I'm able to look at now.
We go now to Jim in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hey, nice to talk to you, Mark and George. To me, it's a conglomeration. You know, the CIA, the anti-Castros, the
mob,
and also,
all of them.
And also, listen, the Gulf of Tonkin or the Operation Northwoods. Kennedy didn't follow through, and also remember, guys. He was trying to change the currency. Remember?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Trying
to change the currency.
You bring up good points, Jim, because a lot of people can't really, you know, in their own mind, they can't imagine the atmosphere back there in 60, 61, 63, and all the things that were going on, and what the Kennedys were trying to do, and you know, all of those kind of things. And that's what you have to do. You have to look at that whole atmosphere to figure out exactly what was going on. There were a lot of dangerous people running around back then. And a lot of them, you know, hated the president and hated Bobby and, you know, all these different things that happened and all of that. And it's important to keep that in mind when you think about what was going on.
I remember a case where people thought that Aristotle Onassis was part of it because he wanted Jackie.
Well, it's very possible. I mean, I'm an open-minded guy, so I'll listen to about anything. But, you know, again, if people can just try to focus on, you know, primary sources, people that were there, and try to get that information, I think that's the best way to get to the truth.
Okay, next up, do we have time? Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hi, Joe. It's your turn. Go ahead.
How are you? I wanted to ask your guest, are there any rumors to the effect that Dorothy Kilgallen could have had a secret notebook or secret notes that would have led up to a book, and who would have access to that?
Joe, you're right. And back then, you know, again, remember, people couldn't go to a copy machine and copy things. Most of it was through a carbon and a typewriter. We only know of one file that Dorothy Kilgallen had. It was a thick file. In the book, it's described what she had. She never let it out of her sight. She took it with her to the last What's My Line show that she did. We know that she had it with her when she was at the Regency Hotel just before she died. We don't know if it ever got to the townhouse. And then, unfortunately, when they found her body, that file disappeared. So unless somebody now comes forward with information for me or the district attorney in New York, unfortunately, that file probably will never be found.
And back to Hoover for a second. He used to get gambling tips on horses from the mob. He didn't want to screw that up, did he?
Oh, no. And again, you know, he's... He played all the cards across the table, you know. He had information about the Kennedys that they didn't want revealed, and so that way they couldn't get rid of him. He was friends, you know, he's the guy who said there wasn't any mafia, remember? And then he, you know, was with them all the time at the racetrack and all of those kind of things. one of the best pieces of information I found in the National Archives, again, was a memo that J. Edgar Hoover had, and it had a Dorothy Kilgallen column in the memo, and beside it we found he had written in longhand, "Wrong, wrong, wrong." And so he was really on top of what Kilgallen was doing. But as I say, Hoover is a real a key to a lot of these things that happened back then, and I think what happened to Dorothy.
I've got a minute left, Mark, and if you had an opportunity to ask Dorothy Kilgallen one question, what would that have been?
Wow, that's a tough one to answer, but it would be, why didn't you take more precautions? You know, you bought a gun, you changed your will. You were worried your son was going to get kidnapped. You told everybody that you were in danger. Why in the world didn't you take more precautions to get some safety so that nobody could get close to you and end your life? That's what I would want to know. What was going through your mind that let you think you were so invincible?
And my answer for her to you, Mark, would be she trusted whoever. She had.
Right on point.
You got it. Okay, hey, thank you. Good luck with the book, and I love your work, okay?
Hey, thank you so much, George. I appreciate it.
Mark Shaw, the book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. Up next, brothers Michael and Peter Diamond. And they're more than just brothers. They're spiritual brothers.